From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 280 with guest Michael Stenicky, recorded Thursday, August 23rd, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Michael Stenicky, and he is the Vice President of Information Technology for EdgeNet-Big Hammer, which is arguably the best company name I've ever heard. He's been working with NLBS and Windows clustering on Windows NT4 server through to 2012, creating clusters with IIS, file systems, SQL, ISA, and Hyper-V, including geographically dispersed clusters. Michael's designed and implemented multiple systems for scalability, high availability, and disaster recovery. Welcome, sir.
Thanks, Richard.
And you clearly have a specialty, although, you know, it's funny how clustering crosses all of these technologies. Although I noticed one was not on the list, and that was Exchange.
I was just going to say that. Well, Exchange kind of masks clustering, but it certainly uses it under the hoods.
Right. It's its own thing. I mean, and I've said this before, Exchange is the only piece of software Microsoft makes that I actually am frightened of.
Actually, I am a longtime Exchange user as well. I've used every version of Exchange Server that was ever released.
Mm-hmm. I like that I'm afraid of it. Like, you know, it's the one product I run that keeps me nervous because mail is special. You know, it lives in its own little world.
And it's become more special over the more recent years.
Yeah, it's one of those products. It doesn't seem to be getting easier. It seems to be getting harder. But, you know, you go back to NLBS, like, I love that technology. That's a good technology. So simple. No single point of failure. This sort of the communism of load balancing.
Full shared nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And a brilliant solution to the problem. Never gets any respect, though, I think.
Well, you know, we use it where I work quite a bit for web servers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing with the size of machines you can get today and how much load you can actually put on a small number of nodes in an NLBS cluster and how much you can really serve off of that. And we're using that today as well as with Server 2012.
This is when I do talks on web scaling, one of the things I say is, you know, you'd be surprised how long you can keep your website down at one server before you really need to go to multiples. Although I find most of the time when my customers want a second web server, it's not for performance, it's for reliability.
Yes.
You agree that same, you find the same experience is more about dealing with hardware failures?
Definitely. We've kind of standardized on four node clusters, mm-hmm, for NLBS, because that gives us the ability when we're doing software deployments to pull half the nodes and drain stop them and update the software testing, and then switch that to production and, you know, pull those online and drain stop the other two. And that way, the entire time, we always have some fault tolerance in the system, even
right,
when we're doing a deployment.
Even during that deployment. And NLBS, even in 2012, still only load balanced by the IP?
Yes.
So if you need to be sticky, or do you just avoid being sticky?
We avoid being sticky.
Sticky bad.
Usually.
Well, and it's been a while since I've had to deal, you know, I've dealt with F5 and Citrix and so forth, where they can load balance on the session cookie. And so if you need to be sticky, and often they do, we don't have that load balancing problem. I'm just wondering if the mega proxies are still our enemies these days on the web.
They are somewhat. It's, you know, I think with broadband being a lot more widely used than AOL, say, back in the day,
right,
that you're, and it's not quite as bad.
It's not what it used to be.
But even for the sites that we develop that need session state, you know, storing that session on the database lets you not have to be sticky.
Yeah.
On the web servers.
Yeah. We, you know, my pitch has always been three reasons to load balance. You want reliability, you want performance, you want rolling updates. If you're sticky, all three of those are broken. So what's the point? You know, if you're going to go to multiple servers, you have to be non-affinite.
Definitely.
And I could talk about web clusters all day long. Is there any particular nuggets for that you think about? Have you looked at 2012's clustering? Has it really changed much?
There's a lot new in 2012
really?
For clustering, and a lot that's being utilized by different parts of the stack. Probably the most exciting thing in 2012 around clustering are all the enhancements to the file system with SMB3.
Mm-hmm.
And the abilities to create the new cluster role of a scale-out file server.
Yeah.
With enhancements in the networking stack and how SMB3 works and the performance you can get with it, the running Hyper-V workload and SQL Server workload off of an SMB3 share is a feasible architecture and not something that you're going to take a huge performance hit at, which is what traditionally you would think you would do.
Yeah. No, I mean, you just said something that up until recently was a crazy talk for Hyper-V. Wait, you're going to put the VHD anywhere other than as close to the machine as possible?
Yes. As well as SQL Server databases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both crazy talk. But
both crazy talk.
It's SMB3 that's really the backbone of this thing, right?
Definitely. And the ability to do a scale-out file server to now give you a highly available file share with the performance necessary.
Now, are we literally talking multiple machines with multiple copies of data?
No. We're talking about the enhancement of cluster shared volume, which was used just for Hyper-V in 2008 R2.
Right.
To now include the file system as one of the workloads to be used with cluster shared volume. And with all the enhancements in that, lets you mount that volume across multiple hosts and then create SMB3 share off of that volume that's now on and accessible from multiple hosts.
Wow. It becomes harder and harder to figure out what a disk actually is anymore.
Yes.
So this is a virtualized disk across multiple machines.
Right. So you can create up to an 8-node scale-out file server, an 8-node cluster.
Hmm.
And have almost 100% seamless transition if you were to lose a file server in that cluster and you had workload going against it.
Nice.
Until the I/O will automatically get redirected to nodes that are still working. And the pause that happens if a node were to go offline looks basically like a disk wait to the machine.
Huh. So it doesn't even realize there's a failure going on. And is it actually NLBS under the hood?
No. It actually is very simplistic on the load balancing part of it. The scale-out file server role
mm-hmm.
Creates DNS entries for the IP address of every node for your network name for your virtual file share.
Okay.
So you're getting round-robin DNS
right.
on the workload, and the SMB3 stack is smart enough that it pulls all of those IP addresses, connects on the first one. If it doesn't respond, it immediately switches to the second one.
Right. So this
so
isn't
on.
Even this isn't even true round-robin. This is just DNS saying, here's five IP addresses for that name. And it's the
right.
client that's smart enough to actually rotate the IPs that it uses.
Correct.
I like that. But it's interesting, you know, round robin has different meanings to different people.
Right. And then also, if you are running large systems with this and you want to make sure you're really balancing your workload and you have some things you want to do around that, you can even take that a little step further with PowerShell and actually query the cluster to find out what hosts are connected to what nodes
mm-hmm.
and actually level those via custom PowerShell if you want to.
Oh, interesting. So you can get quite precise.
Yes.
But they're just doing that all effectively through the command line. Now, would you use the cluster share volumes in a geographical distribution?
With systems that I've worked on, it's not something that we have in the architecture that I have in my
sure.
systems. My data centers are very geographically dispersed. They're 850 miles apart.
Okay.
So I have large latency concerns between my data centers, and there's not a whole lot you can do to help that. Speed of light is still speed of light.
Yeah. DFRS is still the best solution as soon as we want to go there in terms of file storage.
It can be. We use EMC's RecoverPoint.
Oh, really?
Product to do our distance clustering, but that's not something that we're doing currently with cluster shared volumes.
Okay, I mean cluster shared volumes is relatively new technology too.
Yes.
So I mean, it's fair that that's not what it was meant for. It's you know,
exactly.
Just because you could stick it over a long distance wire doesn't make it a good idea.
There are a number of other enhancements in the virtualization stack in 2012 too, mm-hmm. that help you with your DR configurations, like the feature of Hyper-V replica,
mm-hmm.
so you can snapshot your Hyper-V VMs to another server on an interval. So you can get DR other ways without having to do disk replication.
Oh, interesting. So, I mean, when I think about different strategies for Hyper-V, it's, you know, originally was the two servers with a shared iSCSI array. And so the one, they both could, you know, get access to the same VMs. And if one machine tanks, the other one just picks those up and keeps going. And now with the new SMB3 solution, it's like, okay, well, let's dispose of iSCSI and we'll just use a whole bunch of NICs to get some serious speed out of it, and we get more or less the same results. But with Replica, now I could just have two machines with their own drive stores. They're not directly connected, but they're syncing to each other at a regular interval.
Sure, and I'd still probably do, and that's a great solution for doing DR, but if you also need high availability, you probably still want to do a couple of machines at your primary site, so
right.
You have the ability to move that workload around as you're doing updates to the host and
sure.
things like that.
So, I mean, is this the difference between hot failure and warm failure?
Pretty much.
Yeah, so pairs of machines with shared storage, hot solutions, replicas are warm solutions.
Sure. And then, you know, also one of the huge enhancements for Hyper-V in Server 2012 is previously, to do live migration of a VM and move it from host to host online, those machines need to be in a cluster, and
right.
they needed to be sharing that cluster shared volume if you wanted the best performance in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And now you don't need that. You can live migrate a VM from any host to any host within a cluster, without a cluster, or cluster to cluster, however you want to do it. As well as the ability to live storage migration, to be mm-hmm. able to move the storage to other storage if you need to.
It's all very spooky, isn't it?
Yes. The number of enhancements that build on each other in Server 2012 is kind of mind-boggling, actually. Every time I talk about it, I don't know where I should start, because you can walk yourself in a circle really easily.
Oh, sure. I mean, it feels to me like the starting point is the SMB3 file share and clustered shared volumes. Like that seems like the first thing you'd want to implement, because everything else seems to build on top of that.
Yes. Definitely need to think about the other things and the other enhancements that make all of those work better, too. Because the networking enhancements and the network stack and how, you know, the different support for different network cards, mm-hmm. and the ability to do RDMA offload with network cards that support that is definitely something you need to keep in mind in your architecture.
Now, it used to be we had to buy matched NICs for all of this sort of stuff. If I wanted to do teaming, if I wanted to do RDMA offload, like that was, they were fairly specific to the hardware. I thought Microsoft made this much simpler in 2012.
They did. They have inbox NIC teaming in Server 2012. And there are certain features you get with inbox NIC teaming, and there are other features you can get actually without having to team the NICs.
Mm-hmm.
The SMB3 protocol will do the SMB3 direct, as it's called, which is utilizing the RDMA offload.
Okay.
And that's, unfortunately, that's something that is not supported through NIC teaming.
Okay.
So if you want to do the RDMA offload, NIC teaming isn't a good option for that, except the SMB3 protocol also supports multi-channel, where it will automatically spin up multiple threads on all available network cards to transfer your data. So if you had two network cards on the same subnet and are moving a file, it will create multiple threads on both network cards and move the file without NIC teaming.
So you don't actually need to team. You just plug multiple NICs in to the same subnet, which is not something you'd normally do, but it's just a recognition that we could do this. If you've got a NIC laying around not doing anything in a server, just plug it in the same subnet and let SMB3 do its thing.
Correct. And if you think about how the scale-out file server works, is it's going to register all the available IP addresses on that machine. And since SMB3 is smart enough to know how to switch from interface to interface if one doesn't respond, you might not need teaming.
Yeah, that sounds like you have to.
But that's specifically for the SMB3 workload because of the enhancements in the client and the server that can deal with that. That's not going to help you, you know, on your web server where you're trying to serve pages out and when NIC dies.
Right. Yeah, different problem.
Different problem. Different solution.
Yeah. Well, and you said that this is not the fix for everything. Clustering still has a distinct role in all of this and you know, points of identity. What does a virtual instance look like? Well, why do you want to do that? Let's dig into this. What do you actually mean when you talk about a geographically dispersed cluster? Like, what does that look like?
In my environment, the geographically diverse clusters are mainly done with SQL Server. And I'll run multiple nodes at my primary data center. And then I have the RecoverPoint appliance doing block level disk replication to my DR data center onto another SAN and a SQL Server there that's a member of the same cluster. So typical design would be a 3-node cluster, two in the local data center, one in the DR site.
Okay.
And I have the ability to, you know, fail that workload to any one of those three servers. My failover times with my local servers are slightly quicker because I don't need to worry about making sure I'm disk consistent from the replication standpoint. But still, with the connection I have between my data centers and with the technology and the RecoverPoint appliances, with compression and everything that it does to do the block-level replication, I still only sit between 5 and 15 seconds from transactionally consistent on one side to the other.
Well, and this is the thing that always worries me about SAN-based replication, is that it doesn't understand the database transactions that are going on. So
RecoverPoint actually does.
Oh, okay.
It's write level consistent on both sides. So writes happen in the same order. So the only potential you have for loss would be the same as if a server rebooted in the middle of a transaction.
Yeah.
You have to roll back that transaction. It's the same potential for loss is there.
So there's no risk of the idea that a transaction is completed in the log and didn't finish right to the database and it's at an inconsistent state. That's the thing that scares me every time. I've always steered towards replication inside a SQL Server to count on SQL Server to maintain a transactional replication. SAN replications made me nervous just because it had to follow those rules and many of them don't.
Yes, definitely. If it doesn't follow that that write level consistency, you can get into a big problem with that. But the RecoverPoint CE product does that. Mm-hmm.
So not
an issue for our systems, and we've been using it for quite a while. I've had a distance cluster configuration with the RecoverPoint appliance as well as the predecessor company, which EMC purchased. And so I've been running this system since 2003.
Mm-hmm.
So for quite a while.
I mean, this is clearly a tool you could trust now. You know it works. It does the thing it's supposed to do.
Yes, and it's just gotten better over the years as the network bandwidth between my sites has gotten better as well, which just makes the system even more robust. I can watch real-time graphs of how much and what my lag is between committed transactions in the primary data center to what's been committed to disk at the DR data center.
Right.
And, you know, unless I'm doing heavy disk maintenance, I rarely see that past 3 seconds.
Nice. When the traffic load goes up, I mean, if the database is especially busy, that's got to put more stress on the WAN connection too.
It does. It does. But from what I've seen from operating the system, most of that load spikes are created by maintenance of the database, not by actual user load.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's where you intelligently plan the maintenance of your database when your user load isn't the highest. So your potential for affecting users with downtime or data loss is less.
Well, and it's a great discussion about stuff like, if I'm re-indexing databases, why am I sending those changes over the WAN when I just re-index on both ends?
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't work like that.
No, don't have a choice. Got to let the SAN suck it up.
Yep.
Oh, boy. Is it worth breaking the connection, regenerating, and then resyncing?
Not with a big database.
Yeah, just because of the amount of data haul you got to do.
Right.
Yeah.
The system is intelligent enough that when it realizes that you've changed enough bits that the compare is longer than a full resync, it'll right. actually just fire a full resync.
Oh, nice. So it'll figure out if it needs to do that. You don't have to just figure it out itself.
Correct.
Well, let's talk about the front side of the SQL Server. So now these three machines are in a cluster, so they essentially share the same virtual IP.
Yes, for each SQL instance, they do.
Okay, so when an application's communicating by a given name, we're back to the rules of NLBS. Are you actually load balancing here, or is there one owner at two failover points?
So that's not NLBS. It's just a virtual cluster name.
Okay.
Between those nodes. So only one's the owner, only one's active
right.
at one time.
So only one's going to respond. The others are all listening, and it's only when they're master on that database that they would actually respond.
Actually, only one owns the IP address at a time. So the other machines are listening on their unique IPs, mm-hmm. but they don't own the IP for the SQL instance.
Oh, okay.
That cluster resource is only owned by the active node.
Right.
And then in the, you know, the other product that was released earlier this year was SQL 2012. And there's a great enhancement for clustering with SQL that's in SQL 2012, and that's the support for multiple subnet clusters with SQL Server.
Hmm.
So before SQL 2012, you had to do a stretch VLAN between your two data centers because that IP had to be the same IP
right.
on all those cluster nodes. And now you can do multi-subnet with SQL 2012, so I no longer have to do the stretch VLAN. I can do a more traditional routed network, and that simplifies those configurations from a networking side immensely.
Well, VLANing over a WAN is just bad news.
It's not fun.
No. That was the only... This is why we didn't do that. You know?
Yeah.
It's just... It's so painful to do.
And it's why I've had one for the last 8 years. And now, finally, with SQL 2012, I can... You know, I've been able to get rid of it.
So how does that assignation look now? When the master goes down and the remote machine has to take over, does it now take on an IP in that subnet, or how do you map that out?
It takes on an IP in that subnet.
Okay.
And clustering in the operating system has supported this since 2008. With other workloads, you could have those in other subnets. Mm-hmm. And in the cluster object for the IP, there is an OR in the configuration. So the cluster is able to figure out that if the owning node is in the subnet that's the same as one of the IPs, that's the one it should use.
Right.
Or it uses the other one.
Right. So the configuration you've got where you have two machines in the same subnet and a third machine in another subnet is the logical one. So the master fails. It's first going to use the machine in the same subnet. And if that one's not it, then it goes over to the other subnet.
Correct.
All right. And it gets back to this whole thing of just if we've had a hardware failure, the other machine's right there. It's on the same SAN, so it's going to stand up fastest. Things are good. If we've lost the whole site, now you go over to the DR site.
Yep.
All right. I like that. That's very coherent. And, the default behavior makes a lot of sense for that.
And in Windows 2012, there's another really interesting feature around clusters. So in the scenario you just walked through, in that three-node cluster, if I actually lose the full site,
mm-hmm.
My DR site can't come online automatically.
Really?
Because the cluster resource owning is decided by quorum.
And you can't get a quorum.
and I can't get a quorum.
I love it. Oops.
And quorum is one of the things that's probably the most elusive for most people when they create a cluster, because they'll create the cluster and it will all work.
Right.
Until things start to fail, and then things fail in an unexpected way, and the cluster ends up shutting off.
Right.
Which is not what people are expecting to happen.
You mean exactly the opposite of what you wanted from your cluster.
Yes.
Yeah. When the going got tough, we went home.
Yes. And quorum is one of the things that people really need to understand a lot about, and especially since the advent in 2008 and 2002 of being able to do a lot of different workloads in a cluster without having shared disk, that becomes a little more not as evident, I'll say. Because when you have shared disk and you run through the cluster wizard, it automatically figures out, well, I have shared disk. I should put my quorum on this shared disk.
Right.
And when you don't have that shared disk, well, it still works. And if you have an odd number of nodes, you have no problem having quorum voting.
Right.
If you create a file share witness, which was also something that was added in 2008 or 2, you can then give a quorum on a file share, so you can still not have to have shared disk, but still have another quorum vote from that file share witness. But you still have the problem of when you start losing nodes, you will go below the threshold of your number of quorum votes to have quorum, and the cluster will still shut off.
Right.
In Server 2012, there is the idea of something called dynamic quorum.
Okay.
So, say you had a five-node Hyper-V cluster.
Right, which, based on what you just explained, to me seems like now the minimum number.
Yes. or we'll say, you had a five or seven-node, whatever, either one of those, Hyper-V cluster, and you start doing some maintenance on your Hyper-V cluster. So you have a machine down for maintenance, and workload's been moved to other servers.
Right, so you're at four.
And you're at four, and now I lose one.
Right.
Well, now I no longer, I have the potential of no longer having a quorum, and the whole cluster can shut down.
Right. So you're at four, you lose one, you're at three. Those three have to agree to have a quorum, essentially.
Right.
And if they don't for any reason, the cluster's out.
Right. So with dynamic quorum, as long as you don't lose 50% of the nodes at once.
Right.
It will automatically decrement quorum by one vote.
All right.
So in my case of I was a five-node cluster.
Yeah.
My quorum's three.
Right.
I take one out. It'll decrement my quorum to two.
Right. So now one of them takes a header. Two others have to agree and you're good.
Right. And it will do that all the way down to two servers. And then it has to do a 50-50 decision. At the point where you're down to two last servers, if you don't have any other voting mechanism via shared disk or via a file share witness, then when you get down to those last two servers, depending on which server dies, your cluster may stay running or it may turn off because it has to elect one to be the owner.
Right.
And if the owner stays running, your cluster is still going to run down to that last man standing, even without a shared disk witness. If you had a file share witness or a shared disk witness, you can go all the way down to last man standing.
Right.
As long as that disk is up and one node.
Yeah, and I think this is the thing that people don't understand about the whole file share witness in the first place. Like, the reason you want this is to deal specifically with the small configuration, the two machine, three machine setups, because it'll just, when you need it, you'll really, really need it. And the role isn't expensive. You just have to stand it up.
And then the other thing is, realistically, that file share hopefully is on a highly available file share.
Right. You would hope.
Which on 2012, that even is a whole new thing for being highly available for that file share.
Yeah. What does highly available mean now?
Yes.
it sure feels to me, and I think Mark Manassi said ages ago, all these features feel like cloud features. Like they've taken all the stuff they've developed up in their cloud implementations and they've taken them down so that we can all get them.
I think a lot of them are driven around that. I mean, so we're a large SQL Server shop, as you can probably guess from my talk about SQL Server.
Sure.
And you know, when I saw the feature set for SQL Server 2012 on that you could put your SQL logs and data on an SMB share, mm-hmm. I thought to myself, are they crazy? Who would want to do that? That's going to be the worst performance I can think of.
Right.
And I'm like, I thought to myself, this has got to be some kind of feature that's for Azure. There's right. got to be something else here that I just don't know about yet. That became clear when I found out about SMB3 and Windows 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that they're probably using that functionality and that type of thing in Azure.
Well, what's the alternative? They're buying up half of EMC's capacity? Like, there'd be, you know, all these cloud implementations require massive SANs. So you yeah. either are deeply in bed with a couple of major vendors, or you're rolling your own. And clearly, Microsoft's rolling their own with SMB3 and the cluster share volume architecture.
Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the other enhancements in clustering, you know, you can support up to over, was it 4,096 VMs in a single cluster?
Okay. I don't have a requirement quite that big. I can only think of a couple of companies in the world that would.
Yeah, it's up to 1024 on one node.
Wow. That's a big node.
That's a big node. I don't know that I'd want to do that.
No. That just because you could doesn't make it a good idea.
But, you know, that also gives Microsoft the numbers to be on par with any of their competition and saying, you know, look, we can scale these numbers. Not saying you maybe should, but yeah. it'll do it.
Yeah. I like when we hit numbers that are basically sufficient. I yeah. can run more instances than ever would make sense for you to run.
One of the big things I really think is going to be interesting in Server 2012 around clustering mm-hmm. and virtualization is now the native inbox support for InfiniBand.
Yeah, this is technology I experimented with some of my other projects. It's really exciting to see it come to mainstream file servers or, you know, Hyper-V implementations because it's stinky fast. What InfiniBand have you been playing with?
So I have 32 gig InfiniBand.
Wow.
Running TCP/IP over InfiniBand.
Mm-hmm.
And using that with scale-out file server and running Hyper-V and SQL Server workload across that.
So is it just a straight two-way connection or a three-way daisy chain? How far are you going?
I have multiple node scale-out file server
mm-hmm.
With InfiniBand going to an InfiniBand switch, and then multiple Hyper-V servers on that same InfiniBand switch.
And how's the pricing now for InfiniBand? Is it, you know, compared to, say, 10 gig Ethernet?
It's price per gigabit is a lot cheaper.
Wow. Because meantime, we're starting to hear the IEEE talking about going beyond 10 gigabit Ethernet, too. But it seems like yeah. InfiniBand is going to slide in there as a really effective solution.
Well, InfiniBand has been out for a really long time,
sure.
but really been only used in niche and really specific implementations. I think without having, you know, the mainstream support in the server operating system for Microsoft has hurt that adoption.
For sure.
I'm just hoping that now that it does it, that adoption will ramp back up. Because I think as a technology and as a solution, it's been something that's been around for a very long time, and it works, really well.
I mean, the only downside is the InfiniBand plug is pretty big.
It is, but that's not much different than most of the 10 gig stuff.
Yeah. There's something about it that always reminded me of Token Ring. You know?
Yes.
I mean, it's not as ugly as the Token Ring plug, but it's pretty ugly. But, you know,
hopefully no beaconing.
Yeah. And hopefully you got to admit, we can't stay at 8 wires forever. There's only so many ways to twist copper. Right. We're running up against the line on there. So, well, okay.
And looking at, you know, building your own private cloud or building a data center infrastructure, mm-hmm. And really that's what most of the virtualization projects are that companies are doing now when they're trying to, you know, cut down their hardware footprint and virtualize systems on larger boxes. That's really all they're doing, maybe just not on the same scale as what some might think of as the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're only talking about needing to hook together a dozen or 16 or even 50
right.
machines in a data center, what does it matter that you have, you know, a 30-meter limit on your cabling,
yeah.
or you have to use these big cables? It's not like I'm pulling, you know, four strands of 2-gauge wire.
No.
It's not that big a cable.
It's not thick Ethernet.
Right. So it's definitely, I think, a feasible solution and a good solution.
Yeah.
It's definitely cost-effective.
Now, I feel really good about InfiniBand in the 16-server, maybe the 32-server scenario, just because it's super fast, it's short range. That's a rack, maybe two racks worth of gear. That
yep.
the power there is awesome. When you've got a group of hardware that's, you know, working closely together in a cluster the way you're describing, this is the way to go. And you can't argue with the price now.
In some of our test lab configurations, in copying files and moving things around and doing live migrations and doing storage migrations of VHDs, you know, we did a bunch of testing with, you know, 10 and 20 gig, 30 gig files.
Mm-hmm.
And my time to move those files is directly related to the amount of disk I/O I have,
sure.
not the amount of network I have. Because my twin 32 gig InfiniBand connections are more than the disk I/O can
yeah.
handle.
You're now at the limit of what the drive can actually transfer. And it's not yep. until we start building out these arrays with SSDs that we're going to push that line back up again.
Right. And, you know, but on that same note, if I had 10G Ethernet infrastructure in the same as I have the InfiniBand,
mm-hmm.
I would be close to hitting the bottleneck of the wire.
Right.
I'm still at disk in the config that I have here, but just with my test array, my test SAN that I'm using, I'd be close to hitting the maximum I could transfer over 10 gig E.
Yeah, and here you are with roughly three times the bandwidth for less money, and you
yeah.
know InfiniBand's not done. You know,
right.
there are you can go up to the tertiary speeds and the additional multipliers. Like, it can go faster.
Definitely. And it's the stuff that I have is about a year old in InfiniBand technology. So mm-hmm. it's definitely not cutting edge.
No. No, it's...
But it's still that fast.
It's the cost-effective edge.
Yes.
Well, Michael, I think we're just about running ourselves out of time. I didn't mean to go deeply down the InfiniBand side, but when we talk about clustering, part of it is how well we connect these machines together. And I think the ascendancy of InfiniBand in the space is an important part of that. It makes more and more sense to me that those local node clusters should be coupled with as fast a connection as we can make that makes sense. And then we deal with the challenges of WANs and those issues after that.
Definitely. In the ability now in Server 2012 to create these shared nothing clusters for using Hyper-V and for mm-hmm. using SQL Server and just having to have, you know, disk share out there to use, network is most important. Your cluster communication happens across that. Your live migrations happen across that.
Yeah.
Your storage migrations everything happens across the network. It is the key to making that a successful implementation and design.
For sure. The whole thing I see with 2012 is I can gang a bunch of gigabit Ethernet together if I don't want to spend any money. If I want
yep.
to spend a little money, there's some InfiniBand out there that'll take it up a notch.
Or even, you know, just replacing the network cards, the gig network cards are in the box with ones that support RDMA is
yep.
going to get you a huge improvement over what's there if it doesn't already support RDMA.
And they're not that much money.
No, not at all.
Yeah, they're quite reasonable. I think if people haven't spent enough time to actually look at what a server class NIC looks like these days.
And really, you know, when you need to start looking at the 10G configurations, the multiple 10G or the InfiniBand, is really when you want to talk about really high uptime
yep.
and putting, you know, putting 100 VMs on a host. Because when it's time to migrate that off that host, if you have a failure or if you do maintenance,
yeah.
it's all down to that network bandwidth.
Yeah.
It might not be that you need the network bandwidth to run the system, but you certainly need it to maintain the system.
Yep, for sure. And in the crisis. I mean, that's the whole thing I find with most people with their clustering is you haven't actually gone through a crisis with it, so you don't know.
Yes.
Michael Stenicky, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.